Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Folding Pocket.
Welcome to another episode of the Rabbit Hole Detectives, a podcast where I, Dr. Kat Jarman, Richard Coles, and Charles Spencer chase the provenance of historical objects, both real and metaphorical. Each episode, we set one another the task of finding out as much as we can about a particular subject to present a comprehensive understanding of the origin stories of stuff. After all, everything has a history. It just depends on how far down the rabbit hole you're prepared to go. And at the end of it all, our disembodied voice pronounces a winner. Hello again, rabbit holies.
Hello, Kat. Oh my goodness. We've been doing this too long. So Richard and I are now in perfect harmony.
We're going to have to think of a new thing. So yes. I might say good day.
Yes.
Dr. Jarman.
Yes.
There you go.
And I'll have to say something other than hello, rabbit holy. So
I love the intro though. It sets the rhythm very nicely, your intro, for what follows.
We like your Viking hair today, Kat. Our listeners need to know that Kat is sporting the most splendid barnet, and it's sort of Viking style. So you have sort of braids which are laid against your head and gathered in at the back.
Yes, as it was, if I may say it, I think it's as it was when we did our live show in Northampton.
Yes, I haven't kept it in for that long. I will just sort of say that to us. I have washed it in between, but
it's not ceramic. It's been glazed on.
The boss lady Viking in Vikings has it done like that.
It's become the sort of look of Viking women. We don't actually have any evidence that they ever braided their hair like that, but it's become the sort of modern
version. So we all have a clear idea of what Vikings look like because it's conditioned by films and stuff, horned helm. And I suppose there are items of Viking kit that survive. But actually, was it ceremonial? Was it martial? Was it every day? How do they do their hair?
Yeah.
I don't know.
We don't know. So hair is a really interesting one. We actually don't know. And there's things like tattoos as well. So again, a lot of the modern representations of film, there's a lot of tattoos. We have one record of them having tattoos, but we don't know if that was common or...
Not like Machine Gun Kelly. Have you seen Machine Gun Kelly's latest tattoo? He's completely gone the full Monty. The full Monty for Megan Fox.
Isn't it funny? I've got a friend and he got a tattoo and then he just kind of went crazy. And now he has to keep his face free of tattoos for work. But you can feel that every part of him is now annexed by tattoos. And you can see it sort of creeping up above the collar. He's going to start wearing turtlenecks soon or maybe get ordained with dog collar.
But one of the hugest growth markets in cosmetic surgery is the machines to remove tattoos because people regret them, obviously. Yeah. You know, also, when you see, occasionally you see quite elderly people with slightly sagging tattoos from a few decades back, it's not a good look.
Old sailors and things.
Yes.
Have you got a tattoo?
I haven't, but I may well have to get one. I've wanted one since I was about 16.
Really?
So, yeah.
Why would you get a Viking one?
No, this is the reason why I haven't got one, is because I can't decide. So maybe I'm lucky, but I'm feeling like I'm sort of heading towards midlife crisis sort of age. So maybe that's the time.
Oh, it's very bracing, a midlife crisis. I recommend them.
I'm quite looking forward to it.
You're ready to go yet, Kat?
Well, I
wouldn't mind another one, actually. Gets you out of the house and everything.
Yeah. Right. I'm going to start this week. This will surprise you, but I've gone for something quite Scandinavian again this time. The history of skiing and skis, actually. And the word ski obviously has to come from Scandinavia. So it's an Old Norse origin of the word ski. And the Old Norse actually means split. And initially, that's the sort of context of a piece of wood or a billet of wood being split, which of course then becomes the ski. And we can use that term still in Norwegian, meaning a flat piece of wood, not necessarily for putting on your feet.
So would we say a plank?
Yeah, so it's a bit like a plank, essentially, but it's actually, the word comes from the splitting action. Oh, interestingly,
cleaving,
it's
a sort of cleaving.
Yeah, more like that. And it's related, it's got Indo-European roots related to the ancient Greek word schizo, as in schizophrenic, which means divided.
Oh, that's it, because I always thought ski, because it's S-K-I. I just thought that must be a Norse word, because I think that's what Norse words sound like. But actually, of course, if it's...
Yeah, it comes from the same...
Sigma Chi from the Greek, then it's a different thing.
It's got the same origin, which I thought was so interesting.
Yeah.
But the actual skis themselves and the origins of the skis, we don't quite know. And there's lots of debates. And like so many of these things, lots of regions claim them. They're clearly from the north somewhere, possibly Siberia, China. There are some very, very early skis, finds of skis, some claiming to go back almost 8,000 years in Siberia, in the Altai Mountains, but that seems a bit dubious. There's definitely some very early ones from the Scandinavian region. So some dating back about 5,000 years from Sweden and Norway, skis. And when we get into other representations, obviously we have no textual sources from that period at all, but we do get rock art dating back about 4,000 years, both from Russia and Norway. So White Sea region, there's some amazing 4,000-year-old rock art depicting people on skis hunting. And they even have ski poles. And so it looks very much like modern skiing.
Question, Kat. What came first, the snowshoe or the ski?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So a lot of people do think that they may have come from snowshoes, that people start putting something a bit rounder and a bit more sort of firm.
Yeah.
And then eventually that develops into the ski. But we've not found enough evidence of that, so we can't say.
I had to go in snowshoes. And while they work, and they distribute your weight more evenly so you stay on top of the snow, the first thing, within 5 seconds, you're thinking, oh, I wish these went faster forward.
Yes.
So the ski invented itself.
Yes.
Exactly. I mean, it seems like that sort of movement forwards, it makes so much sense, doesn't it? And we just talk about those early examples, though. My absolute favourites are some that were found quite recently in Norway, because most of them are very fragmented, those really early ones. But in 2014, archaeologists working in Norway at the Digervarden ice patch, looking at these glaciers that melt away, found essentially a complete 1,300-year-old ski, which also included the binding. And that's extremely rare, because we don't normally have any evidence of that.
And sorry, Kat, would that have been animal leather and stuff?
Yeah, so leather and birch binding. So we've got these three different parts of sort of twisted birch bindings and a leather strap that goes around the heel. So they sit on really nicely. And amazingly, in 2021, they actually found the second, so they found the other one that matched it. So they have a complete set from the same place.
Fantastic.
Which is brilliant. And they're great. I mean, they're really long, 187 centimetres long. So they're
gosh,
they're
that's
pretty
nearly as long as me.
Yes, and quite wide. There's a big question of whether they had fur lining on the bottom, because there are some that have fur underneath, which is great with grip. So depending which way you go, so if you go with the hairs, they go really nice and smooth, but against it, they stop. So it's a really clever way of doing it.
There's a modern parallel of that. You know what? In curling, you have a slippy shoe and a sticky shoe, and the slippy one has got a flat bottom, so it just glides over the surface, and the sticky one has grooves that go in the same direction, same principle. So you can apply some grip with that.
Yeah.
And I can't ski as such, but I do this thing called ski touring, which is a sort of alpine skiing where you walk up and you have a skin, it's called. So still based on the same principle as you. While you're climbing up, you have the skin on the bottom of the ski, and then you undo it for the short ski expedition on the way down the mountain. Yeah, so it's used for the grip on the way up. So things haven't evolved very much.
Absolutely. Well, if it works, it works. And we have this description among this being used among the Turks, actually, in the 10th century. So actually using animal hair underneath on ski. So it's clearly something that people do all over the place. So we don't get any written records really, there's quite a bit from the medieval period onwards. But the earliest reference to skis in a written record seems to be from China, actually, and that's from the 3rd century BC. And there's a record of the Altai Mountains of people who wear the horns of a goat, a kind of knee-high fur boot under which is a wooden board with a hoof-shaped front tip. But In terms of literature, again, in Scandinavia, we've got the sagas, the saga literature that relates to the Viking Age. That's when we start getting stories, not just sort of simple descriptions like that other one, but the first sort of stories of cultures using them very actively. So we hear about the Lapps and the Sami people being particularly good at skiing and hunting on skis, which makes sense with that whole sort of Russian, northern Scandinavian region. And we hear about a lot of the named Vikings, so people like Harald Hardrada, so the one who's often known as the last Viking, who famously went up against Harald at Stamford Bridge in 1066. He really bragged about his skiing skills, apparently, and said he was one of the best. And they had lots of competitions, lots of essentially the skills being practiced and honed. Is also in these sources passed down from the Norse gods, and their suggestion that skiing was learnt from Odin. Other records say that Thor's stepson Ull was in fact the
who?
Ull.
How would you spell
U-L-L?
Okay, yes. That's pretty
good. Not too bad. He's also described as the god of skiing and archery and hunting and poetry. Also associated with fertility rites and human sacrifice. So
he's got everything covered, really, hasn't he?
His portfolio, yeah.
Exactly. There's a ski goddess as well called Skada, who lives in the mountains and skis and hunts. So this is clearly a really important part of early medieval culture in Scandinavia and the skills of it.
It's a great breakthrough, isn't it? I mean, if it was initially just a sort of platform to stand on the surface of the snow, then someone says, oh, no. It's like inventing the bicycle. Yeah. All of a sudden, you're just at speed, aren't you? And that must have changed the way they hunted, changed the way they engaged with territory. Fascinating.
Absolutely. But I love the fact that early rock art, where you really see it, and you see some of them have got tracks, and you can see the prints from the poles, and you can see them interacting with the animals as well. And clearly realising if you're in a snow-covered territory and you're relying on hunting in the winter, you don't have much choice, really.
I don't want to anticipate what you're going to say, so maybe this is coming, but when did they start going downhill?
Yeah, so that doesn't happen until quite a bit later, and that's really when it starts becoming more of a sport, really. So it's not a practical thing. It's really 18th to 19th century that takes place. This is also when it spreads much more from Scandinavia, especially to other countries across Europe. And we have adaptations to different regions, so especially when it really starts to kick off in the Alps. You have much steeper mountains. And so, again, the techniques start developing. And there's not so much focus on cross-country skiing, which, again, is really the biggest thing in Scandinavia, which is a bit more like what you do, really. Mm. And that's much more about moving, I suppose. Although some of those sagas do also talk about downhill skiing, really, because of competitions going down mountains. Yeah.
So they were sort of testing their mettle by doing that. They love testing their mettle, didn't they?
Absolutely. There's a lot of it is about competitions and skill. So yeah, you have it in there. But really, what we know of it more in modern time is 18th to 19th century, when it really starts to kick off. And that's we start getting ski clubs, ski schools, and eventually we also have equipment improving. So you have laminated skis, you get metal edges and bindings. In the 1800s, we have skis arriving in North America, so USA and Canada. And that's with the Norwegian immigrants taking the skis with them, and it gets adopted quite quickly. It also becomes a bit of a household word, the skiing, as an idea in the late 19th century, when somebody called Fridtjof Nansen, who was essentially partially explorer, lots of other things going for him as well, a Norwegian, led the team that made the first crossing of the Greenland interior on cross-country skis in 1888. And he wrote a book about this that was translated into lots of European languages. And that skill of using the skis in that way became very well known. Interestingly, in the late 19th century, we also see the military use of skiing developing quite a lot. So across Europe, there's an interesting development also of the biathlon, so what later becomes the sport, and which is rifle shooting on skis. And that's quite a unique one in terms of sports. Yeah,
it's quite good. Winter Olympic sport.
That's right, yeah. So cross-country skiing.
It's the one that Norway always wins.
Yeah, one of them, yeah. But it's probably because we've been doing it for hundreds of years. This really starts very much in the 1860s. Somebody called Oscar Wergeland, who was a military officer. Now, people, especially in Sweden and Norway, there have been various contests at the border where they were rifle shooting. And in the 1800s, again, military forces had been using skiing, developing their skiing skills, understanding that to move across these landscapes in the winter is quite important. But Oscar Wergeland wrote a book on specifically ski drills for troops. And that was taken up quite widely across Europe for ski troops. So various military forces from that point on, late 19th century, essentially started building in ski troops as a part of their military powers. And it's really after that, that skiing develops very much as a sport. So we have more attention to things like the race to the South Pole between Amundsen and Scott, which famously goes very well for the Norwegians and not so well for the Brits.
Thanks for rubbing it in.
Sorry.
Because I just thought that when you were talking, I just thought, I can imagine those pictures of Scott in his exhibition and they weren't, they just had boots, didn't
yes.
they?
Yes, so they decided to go for good boots and walking. That was going to be their main approach, whereas the Norwegians went for skis and dog sledges to
yes,
carry
Yes, we
all
had horses,
stuff.
Didn't we? Horses and boots.
Yeah.
What a daft thing to have done. Why not ask the Norwegians who live in a snowy, icy place how to do that?
Precisely. So that was one of the big things. And
that's
then,
really interesting. I didn't know that. I always wondered why did Amundsen... Well, Amundsen was just covered more ground more quickly, of course.
Yeah, and also much better prepared. He'd studied... He had a rucksack.
You know, oh, of course. Well, there you are. That's the edge.
We talked about that before. But, you know, much better prepared and having all that training on winter, moving on the winter. So it's so much more efficient. So from that point, there's some fighting in the, actually in First World War, but also later on in Second World War, there are various places where skiing becomes very important. In Second World War, for example...
Finland, wasn't it?
Yes, precisely. So Russian... Yes. invasion of Finland, and they're fighting them on skis.
I get very confused with the wars. There was the Winter War, wasn't there? There was First World War, there was Russians, there was so much warfare happening in Finland.
There's a lot of, wasn't it Austria and Italy and the Alps? So it's a lot of that in the First World War. And the Second World War, the main one I know is the Finnish against the Russians on skis.
Yeah, absolutely. And they were wearing white as well and managing to use their camouflage yes. and their skiing skills. So that sort of happens on one day, and then we start getting the Winter Olympics. The first Winter Olympics take place in 1924 with cross-country skiing and ski jumping. And it's only in 1936 that downhill skiing, alpine sort of competitions come into the Winter Olympics as well.
Norway.
They do very well.
But you yes. always do, don't you?
Yeah.
It's your thing.
Yes.
It is our thing.
Sailing, you're good at that too.
Yeah, I mean, again, these are the traditional skills that you had to really learn, I think. Yeah.
Well, we're very good. The English are very good at sitting down sports, aren't they? Like sort of bicycles and sailing and rowing. And
yeah.
keep it simple, not too athletic.
I never thought that. Now they're sitting. My father was tanks. And I said, why did you choose tanks? And he said, so I could sit down.
Excellent.
That's good planning, isn't it?
I love that. So do you want to hear my favourite facts on skiing? Well, they go back to some of those earlier skills in the hunting, especially on skis. And you know how we were saying that it made sense we have these rock art and things for people hunting on skis. And there's a tribe in Siberia called the Ustyak tribe. And they have a god called Tunkpox, who went elk hunting on skis yes. and he chased an elk across the heavens. But in desperation, the elk jumped to earth and the god followed, but he broke one of his skis. Now, this story can be seen in the Milky Way across the sky because that is, in fact, the god's ski track. And when you see it divides, so splits off and lanes converge, that's when it goes from two skis to one because one of them broke off.
Oh.
And this idea of chasing elks is also in the 13th century in Norway. There's a Norwegian law, the Gulatings law, where in 1247 they banned hunting of elk on skis during the winter because it was too effective, basically.
Yes,
it was
just unfair on elks.
It wasn't fair, and they realised that that would completely obliterate the elk population. I think we got a comment from the disembodied voice.
Yes, I'll just clarify that Scott had used dogs in his first expedition, but felt that they had failed him. Mm. And he also did have skis, but he and his team just weren't experienced enough to be able to make use of them effectively. And that's when he then transitioned to using ponies instead.
So Titus Oates, the most famous hero from that expedition, who basically sacrificed himself, as it turned out, in vain. He was in charge of the horses on that expedition.
There's a noble death. I'm going out, I may be sometime.
It's good, isn't it?
Yeah.
Lucky somebody jotted it down, because it would have been terrible if it had been wasted as a gesture.
Do you ever think about your own last words, just to have something handy to say in the event of the Reaper?
It's so true.
Then what if it isn't actually a time and you've already said it, you're wasted and you have to come up with
and
another?
And then in the end your last words are, oh, I need the bottle. It's not the same, is it? Yeah.
Quiet exit. Excellent.
So from that, I think we're going to move on to you, Richard, this time. And again, you have to explain this one. County Palatine of Durham?
The County Palatine of Durham. Not the only County Palatine. Well, there are Duchy Palatines as well. Well, the County of Chester, the Earldom of Chester, was a County Palatine. But of course, that is now a title that is bundled in with the Prince of Wales. The Duchy of Lancaster was a Palatine duchy, but that went to the monarch. And so now, interestingly, the Queen, or the King, is Duke of Lancaster, and therefore retains the sort of Palatine rights, although they're the sovereign rights. Did you know that the income of the Duchy of Lancaster remains the sovereign's personal income and is not folded into crown incomes? There you go. The County Palatine of Durham is slightly different. And what is a County Palatine?
Yeah, I was going to say, can you explain the word Palatine to
Palatine,
me?
Well, it's sort of derived really from the same derivation as palace. And what it means is that the person who is the Palatinate in charge of a Palatine has effectively sovereign powers. It's not a sovereign, it's someone appointed by a sovereign. But in that district, they exercise sovereign powers. So if you were a Count Palatine, you would be able to mint your own money, you'd be able to raise an army, you'd be able to levy taxes, and you'd be able to run your own judiciary as well. Durham's an interesting one. This is right up your street, because if we go to Northumbria, the Kingdom of Northumbria, the area of Northumbria, Northumberland today, that part of the northeast of England, famously independent then and now, it was very much the kind of realm of St. Cuthbert, who we associate with Durham, of course. St. Cuthbert was not only a very holy man, but he was an extraordinarily powerful man in that part of the world. And the people who came there were known as the holy people because they belonged to Cuthbert. And so Cuthbert retained enormous prestige in that part of the world. And it was a tricky part of the world because occupying powers, the Vikings came in, of course, and then you had the warring powers to the north of the Tyne and you had the warring powers to the south of the Tyne. If you had an interest in that part of the world, it was worthwhile giving the person in charge the powers to make their own decisions so you could act swiftly in the event of invasion, for example. So raising an army, mobilising an army, declaring war, all those kind of powers, normally sovereign powers, would be delegated to whoever was in charge of the Palatinate. Now, it all got a bit interesting, really. Your Viking king of York, he did a deal which enabled that part of the world to retain sovereign powers because he needed a buffer zone between his own interests and those of hostile interests. It was more sort of formalised after the conquest when William the Conqueror put in his own guy. And at that point, the powers went through a complicated sort of system of negotiation to the bishops of Durham. And so the bishops of Durham were the prince bishops, as they were known, of the Church of England, uniquely so. Prince bishop, it's basically a translation of Fürstbischof, it's a German word. And it did mean the sort of leading ecclesiastic who also had the powers of a count or an earl, effectively to govern a county. So Durham had those folded in to the bishopric of Durham. So if you were the Bishop of Durham, you were a prince bishop. It's retained today, actually. If you look at the crest of the bishops of Durham today, the mitre stands on a coronet, uniting both secular temporal power and also ecclesiastical and spiritual power. And it was useful because if you were the William the Conqueror or his successors ruling England, you were a long way from what was happening up in the north, and you needed to have these buffer zones between your realm and the realms of your hostile neighbours. So, for example, the Duchy of Cornwall. Now, that, of course, is, again, the prerogative of the Prince of Wales, I think, is it, the revenues from the Duchy of Cornwall. Similar sort of Palatine rights. It was because it was distant from the centres of royal power, and people there needed to have sufficient powers in order to respond quickly to threats that came. The Marcher Lords in between England and Wales, same sort of thing. They weren't actually counted Palatine, but same sort of thing. But this meant the Bishop of Durham became an extraordinarily powerful person. This is why if you go to Durham, if you see Durham Cathedral and Durham Castle, part of the same ensemble, possibly one of the best views in all England, isn't it? If you take the train north and you look to your right as you head towards Scotland and you see Durham Cathedral. But it does look quite fortress-like. And the reason was it was quite fortress-like because these were important strategic centres and you needed to hold them. If you go and you see the Bishop's Palace in Durham, no longer lived in by the Bishop, but there's an exchequer there. Why would you have an exchequer? Because he was minting his own currency as Bishop of Durham. Years went on and those powers sort of waxed and waned a little bit. The Commonwealth took them away. The Restoration restored them. Something about regime change and then the return to the previous regime meant that status quo needed to be reasserted, I guess. Henry VIII, when Henry VIII started really reducing ecclesiastical power and extending royal power to fill the gap left behind it, that those rights began to be eroded. One of the rights you had, if you were Bishop of Durham as a prince bishop, was you had rights to the revenues of the mines of Durham. And of course, Durham happened to be built, by this time, I should say, the County Palatine was roughly the area between the Tyne and the Tees. And that area coincides with the northern coalfield. So there are extraordinary riches there.
So you say they were bishops and counts, as it were, at the same time. If you were a king of England, were you thinking primarily of their military ability as opposed to their ecclesiastical one when you appointed them, do you think?
Slightly complicated, but I think as long as there were threats from the north in particular, it made real sense if you were the King of England to have somebody with those powers in the north. Of course, that's not without tensions, I guess. And there were occasions where those conflicts did erupt. For example, sometimes kings would send their officials into the territory of the Prince Bishop of Durham, and the Prince Bishop of Durham would respond quite smartly. And there was, in fact, a massacre of royal officials in Durham. I think 80 of them were killed when they overstepped that mark. But it made sense. Of course, no king would tolerate that kind of potential lèse-majesté were it not in his or her interest to do so. The coalfields made the bishops of Durham extraordinarily rich, of course, the exploitation of that. And they lived very splendidly. They eventually left Durham Castle and they moved to Auckland Castle. So Auckland Castle, which is one of the most splendid castles in a part of England was full of castles, was really their domain. We think of the northeast now, don't we, as a place famous for people who are independent in character and spirit. It's true in football, it's true in industry, it's true in popular culture, but it was true also for bishops. The bishops of Durham were famously independent. Bishop Butler, great philosopher of the 18th century, scourge of the deist. He was Bishop of Bristol, known for that, but he was also Bishop of Durham, and he enjoyed certain privileges. Do you remember the notorious Bishop of Durham, David Jenkins, in our own time?
Yes.
Who was accused of calling down divine wrath upon York Minster, which is the Minster Church of the province of the north in which Durham lies, for being misquoted as saying the resurrection was a conjuring trick with bones. What he actually said was the resurrection was not a conjuring trick with bones, but he spoke with a sort of authority that came, I think, with the confidence of knowing that you did have these special powers. The Bishop of Durham today, who has no palatine powers anymore, nonetheless retains ex officio a seat in the House of Lords. Most bishops rotate and you get your seat in the House of Lords on the basis of seniority. Durham, Winchester, London, Canterbury and York, so they're historic foundations, get one ex officio. Some extraordinary bishops of Durham, Brooke Foss Westcott, one of the great scholars of the church. Another thing that bishops of Durham were often scholarly. Butler, Jenkins and Foss Westcott, who did the Westcott Hort edition in the New Testament. He was also known as the miners' bishop. He did an awful lot to reconcile miners who went out on strike or were locked out, in fact, by mine owners, 1892, 1893. He was a mediator of that, known as the miners' bishop. Michael Ramsay, another great intellectual bishop, also Bishop of Durham. He was considered a friend of the miners. In fact, the relationship between the bishops and the miners was so close that at the miners' gala, that great celebration of working class independence and culture in the northeast, finishes with the cathedral service at which the Bishop of Durham traditionally preaches. Brooke Westcott's last sermon a week before he died was to the miners in the cathedral after the miners' gala. Not always the case, of course. There were other bishops who were more mindful of their interests in coal mining, were not committed to perhaps the alleviation of the burdens placed on the working man. One of them sent his men in, actually, when there was a miners' strike because the revenues were The Golden Prebend. Do you know about this?
I've heard of it, but I don't know what it is.
The Golden Prebend was the richest prize in the Church of England, and it was a prebend stall. It was like a canon stall in Durham. But it came with such extraordinary wealth attached to it through mining that people clawed their way towards it. My favourite predecessor is Vicar of Findon, Sir John Dolben, Baronet. He achieved the Golden Prebend, so he was a very handy man, because it was worth so much, because it came with these revenues attached. But you cannot sustain... Imagine as we go through history, especially when we go to the 19th century and the spirit of reform is abroad, retaining these ancient privileges becomes harder and harder to justify. This is an old story. So in 1836, a law was passed that deprived the Bishop of Durham of those princely temporal powers, and they went back effectively to the state to be administered centrally in the interests of the crown. The one thing that really endured was the Court of Chancery. So one of the privileges of the Prince Bishop of Durham was to preside over a Court of Chancery, and it's an equity court, a court which they initially involved as sort of correctives to courts of law, where if the application of law was done with such rigour, the sum of the effect was, in fact, to reduce the benefit rather than increase the benefit, then a court of equity could come in to moderate that. Mm. And the Court of Chancery for the County Palatine of Durham was only abolished in 1972. Did you know that?
Yeah, well.
I mean, these are kind of things that kind of hung on and hung on and hung on, but eventually needed to be tidied up. And that's why I think that one of the reasons why the northeast of England has such independence of character is because it was literally written into its constitutions and its daily experience of the exercise of power and authority. Would you like
your favourite fact?
A favourite
yes,
fact.
Yes.
Bishop Auckland, step with me to the Bishop's Palace at Auckland. It's now actually owned by a trust. It was rescued by Jonathan Ruffer, who is a businessman who made a great deal of money and is also a devout Christian. And about 10 years ago, I think, he gave 15 million quid that it might be preserved. So the Bishop of Durham maintains offices there now, but it belongs to the Auckland Castle Trust. But it has in its dining room, a dining room built specially for this, the famous Zurbaran portraits of Jacob and his sons, right? Mm. Painted by the great Spanish painter Zurbaran. They think they were obtained by piracy, actually. They were destined for the New World, and the ship that was carrying them was acquired, if you like. And anyway, the paintings, the 13 paintings, ended up at Auckland Castle. Only a great potentate would do that, of course. And he did it because he was deeply committed to equality for Jewish people. This was the bishop, who was called Richard Trevor. And in 1754, he was a supporter of the Naturalisation of Jews Act, also known as the Jews Act of 1754, which gave the rights of naturalisation to Jews resident in England. And one of the ways of expressing his commitment to a more generous dispensation towards people of Jewish faith was to mark the patriarch and the sons, Jacob and his sons, in that way. But one of them is a fake. It's not actually a fake, it's a copy. So there's this suite of 13 portraits by Zurbaran. Richard Trevor, the Bishop of Durham, Prince Bishop, comes in and tries to acquire it. And then one of them is sneaked out, grabbed from literally out of his fingers by the third Duke of Ancaster. And it hangs today at Grimthorpe Castle in Lincolnshire, despite the bishop's best efforts to try to commit. What a mean thing, don't
that's
you think?
That's so bad to break up the set.
Yeah.
Yes, that is a shame.
A bishop's dozen, like a baker's dozen of 13.
So Richard Trevor had an artist by the name of Pond, actually, do a copy of, I think it's Benjamin. Yes, it is Benjamin. And so the portrait of Benjamin, hanging still in the dining room at Auckland Castle, is a copy, and the descendants of the Dukes of Ancaster hang on to theirs at Grimthorpe Castle.
A good copy?
Yes, it is. It's a very fine copy indeed. But here's the thing. 1754, this new law was passed. The Jew Bill became an Act of Parliament. But it was repealed only a couple of years later because a rapidly anti-Semitic reply came from the citizenry of Britain, who did not wish the Jews to become naturalised citizens at all, and tells us of a long, one might say, endless and constantly flaring up enmity between Gentiles and Jews, which lasts, I'm afraid, to this day.
Oh dear, very thought-provoking stuff.
Sorry.
No, that's very good.
No, very good.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So finally, we're going to go on to you, Charles. And this is a topic that you have really been thinking about quite a lot over the last few years, not just this last week, because your new book is just out this week. Congratulations.
Congratulations.
So you're going to be talking to us about boarding schools.
Well, before I start this topic, I should sort of give a warning to those who had a particularly difficult time at boarding school. This may be upsetting, but I have to say, I think like Richard, I mean, going away to board was part of a culture that seemed very normal when we were young.
Point of order. I was a day boy.
Oh, at Wellingborough, yeah. Yes. But I think among different people, a different way of thinking is how I'd see it, is the way of a boarding school. And I do know from a lot of friends from overseas that they find the whole idea of sending young children, not teenagers, but young children off to board, which is what I'm really going to look at today, a very, very bizarre point of Britishness. And also, there is a movement at the moment by a sort of boarding school survivors group in Britain to make it illegal for children under 13 to be sent away to board because it can be such a traumatic event. So I went on the 12th of September 1972 to my boarding school, a place called Maidwell Hall in Northamptonshire.
Age, please.
Just 8. And I had been dreading it for 6 months. I'd never spent a night away from home without a member of my family there. And for 6 months before, I had nightmares. I remember my recurring nightmare, which was my father, who was the parent I lived with, taking me for a walk through a very threatening looking zoo. And he was impeccably dressed, which was the case for him then. And he was taking me as a boy through this landscape. And I knew it was very dangerous. And I think the zoo was representing the place I was going to be sent to, the boarding school culture. And there was a wolf there with a telescopic arm that claimed me night after night while my father sauntered on. And I think really the sort of nature of boarding schools was the boy, again, I don't know a lot about girls' schools, although my three sisters all went to boarding schools, but the child, let's say, is taken away and in return for being ripped away from home or leaving home, depending on their emotional state, they end up in a life of privilege and advantage. And when I looked into boarding schools, and for this book, a very private school, I noticed that really they were trading posts for a declining or declined aristocracy, and people from more aspiring backgrounds, more successful maybe financially, who wanted to really inculcate their children into a culture that they looked up to for social or aspirational reasons. And this is a point that George Orwell took into account. He wrote an absolutely eviscerating account of his boarding school existence called Such, Such Were the Joys. And he went in the early 20th century to one of the plethora of boarding schools on the south coast of England, near where you live, actually, Richard, the Sussex coast, really, that seemed to be populated by an enormous number of very bogus majors who liked young chaps to be around and became their headmasters and set up schools with perhaps not an enormous amount of professionalism, brought to head, actually, in fiction by one of the characters I dealt with in a previous episode, Evelyn Waugh, with Decline and Fall, one of the great representations of boarding school.
Captain
Grimes. And all of the rigmarole of these totally eccentric and quite dangerous teachers. George Orwell wrote about his headmaster, who was a vicious man who would beat him. Having gone to the school aged 8, he regressed to the point of being 4 before he could control himself in bed and was bedwetting. And the headmaster once broke his cane, beating Orwell as a young boy for being a dirty little fellow, as he called him. So I think the problem with boarding schools was this, that in previous generations, and I'm going back into the early 1800s really, parents thought, well, this is going to do them good and off you go. And we don't really want to hear too much about it. And there was a sort of complicity among parents who had been at these schools who knew how bad they were, but weren't going to deviate from what was expected by their social group, through to ignorance from parents who hadn't experienced these schools and thought they were going to do them a lot of good anyway. And so you have this sort of, an emphasis on a sort of muscular Christianity being the backbone to a lot of English private schools.
Tradition of Matthew Arnold at rugby, that sort of thing.
Absolutely right, Richard. He is the epitome of it. He was the most, well, I'd say the most celebrated schoolmaster of the 19th century in England. And he saw Christianity as key and moral rectitude and education as very much third runner-up in terms of what you were going to get from these schools. It was going to turn out people from the right stuff. And that comes to the crux of what I believe these boarding schools are about, which was producing an officer class for the British Empire. You take these people from what the schools and what society would consider good backgrounds, and you cauterize their emotions at a very early age so they are not capable of homesickness. They are very biddable. They're going to be useful when they are influential. And if you went through the right track of a boarding school from, say, the age of 8 to 18, you could come out as a very useful participant in the perpetuation of the empire. I've mentioned George Orwell, so I'd use him as a very good example. He got a scholarship to Eton, got through Eton, and then within 2 years of leaving Eton, age 20, he was in charge of an area of what was then Burma, controlling 200,000 civilians.
Yeah.
Now, that's not on the basis of merit. That's because he was known to have the capabilities after 10 years in boarding school of doing what was expected of him.
So it's interesting, isn't it, that that sort of recapitulated the career of Rory Stewart in our own time, a contemporary of ours, another old Etonian who, in his work in the Foreign Office, ended up being effectively in charge of whole chunks of Iraq after the war there.
Yes.
It's a similar sort of thing, isn't it?
It is a similar thing. And I've listened, you know, when I was researching this, I listened and read an enormous amount about contemporary people, such as the actor Rupert Everett. And he was on Desert Island Discs on the BBC. And he talks about exactly what I said, his emotions being cauterized. It didn't work for him at all. I mean, he hated every second of his boarding school existence because he was creative and flamboyant, and he was not part of what was expected. I think he went to Ampleforth, but at a traditional school.
Yeah, brought up by Benedictine monks.
Yes. Yeah. And again, Damian Lewis, for instance, is another one who's gone on record, who's basically said the most violent experience of his life was being dumped at a boarding school aged 8 as a new boy. It's sink or swim time.
Yeah.
I remember that day in September in 1972 when I went, boys being absolutely shell-shocked by the experience, as one of my contemporaries hadn't been told by his parents that he was going to be left there. So he's looking for his parents, and they thought it was best just to leave him and go.
And a friend of mine who was a boarder at my school, who, again, whose parents didn't tell him that they were going to leave, and so he was stopped, and then he was put to bed, and then he cried, and then he heard a woman's voice coming down the corridor. It was his mum come to get him, and he rushed out. And of course, it was his matron, not his mum at all.
No.
He never forgot that feeling of just dread that he was kind of stuck there.
Yes. I remember when the very first moment I was taken to boarding school, my father, who was a very sweet and gentle chap, very old-fashioned, but so loving, and he could see this was a very big challenge for me, probably because I'd been crying in the car for 2 hours. And he went up to the matron, who was a horrible woman, name check for Mrs. Ford, she's long dead. And he said to her, Charles has never stayed a night away from home. Would it be all right for someone just to keep an eye on him while he settles in? And she summoned this boy after a little bit of thought. And then when my father left, it turned out he was the school bully. And he looked me up and down and just went, you're on your own. And that was the only time he spoke to you. So in a way, I mean, I would say, what are the plus points for a boarding school? From my own experience, come out with a lot of good friends for life. And, you know, there were fun times. But the privilege of it is very debatable in my mind. You know, the school I went to was in those days really quite horrific in many ways. The beatings, the sheer abuse that was really fanned by the then headmaster. It was a sort of very unregulated environment. And it's something my family subscribed to because we've done it for generations. I found early 1700s Spencers, early 1800s, early 1900s, I found the diaries, the letters, and the common denominator among the parents and the aunts and uncles sending these eight-year-olds away was this. Thank goodness they don't know how grim it's going to be, but it'll be good for them in the end. And so that was the philosophy.
So it was supposed to be kind of tough medicine.
Tough medicine. One of my friends who had a particularly bad time at boarding school went to see his parents aged 55 and said, look, it really was awful. And the parents laughed in his face and told him to get out and just grow up. And it was this sort of, we don't want to know about this. Another one, one of my contemporaries, was taken to my boarding school on his first day. And that was the only day his parents came during his 5 years there. They never spoke about it. My friend has said the only time his parents ever brought up the subject of our boarding school was his mother being annoyed and saying what a bore it was when the school told her that he kept wetting his bed. She had to arrange to find an expert in London to come and tell him off.
Very tiresome.
And so how much contact were you allowed to have with your family?
I went to the school between 72 and 77. Obviously, no computers and no cell phones, but no landline either. And it was one letter home a week on a Sunday, written under supervision. And the master on duty would helpfully put up on the blackboard the subjects you were meant to put. So, so-and-so getting three goals at football or something. So nothing could be troublesome for the parents about conditions.
Maidwell, the school you're talking about, Charles, is not actually very far from where you lived. It's only a few miles away.
It's 10 miles, yes.
10 miles away. But was that an easy 10 miles to reach? Or was it, could it have been 100 miles away?
Well, it started, my first 3 years, it was 100 miles because I lived in North Norfolk.
Oh, yeah.
But it didn't really matter because parents weren't allowed to visit. And it didn't matter if you lived a mile away or 150 miles away.
Just not for practical reasons, really, in sort of logistics. Because I know that in Norway, for example, we don't really have boarding schools. It's only in the really remote areas where kids literally cannot get to school and they would board. So it's not that, is it? It's a very different reason.
So the 50 years ago when I was sent away, I mean, I'm sure it's much easier now. Certainly Maidwell is a place with pastoral care and things that would never have been contemplated when I was a boy. You were going there because it was the right thing to do. When I've talked to parents who had their sons very badly abused at this school back then, their defence is, well, everyone was doing it.
Putting on my safeguarding hat, Charles, sending an 8-year-old away to an unregulated environment to which parents have no access and with which that child has no means of communication is a recipe for disaster.
It can be.
Because it could be just a kind of like shooting fish in a barrel for someone who's interested in young boys might not be entirely to their benefit.
Well, certainly the headmaster I had was a very, very bad man or did very bad things. And so he made it into a school that was almost impenetrable. The parents were not allowed into the school building except your first day there. The governor's meeting was in London, a very safe distance away. And he recruited people who were either in tune with him or were likely to be mute. And it goes to the point, actually, of my favourite fact is actually a very short one, and it is a comment that the late Duke of Westminster made when he was questioned. You know, he came from this noble lineage. He'd had a terrible time at boarding school himself, and somebody said, why aren't you sending your children to boarding schools? And he said, why would I want to send my children to live with people I don't know, and if I did know, I wouldn't like. And that sort of sums up the dangerous side of it.
Gosh, yeah, it's quite glad that things have changed, I suppose. But you've obviously written a lot about this in your book, so people can read it. It's out now.
Yeah. I mean, I called it a very private school because it is a private school that was made more private to suit the peccadilloes of the masters in charge. It's been a horrible process, to be honest. But I look back on it and I think it was an all too common phenomenon 50 years ago to have schools with very bad people in charge.
But also how striking it is and how remote in it seems to our own values that a parent would think that subjecting a child to some brutal environment in which their emotions would be stifled would be good for them.
It's astonishing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I have many children and my youngest one, you both know, Charlotte, she gets so bored. I say to her when she comes back from school, pretty regularly, I say, are the teachers being nice to you? And she goes, yes, Dad, you know, so bored about it. But in my day, it's not a reflection on my parents in particular. My parents never asked me what school was like. And it never, ever crossed my mind or the other people I was there with to talk about it with our parents because we didn't have those conversations.
But also, I guess if your parents grew up in a world where those were considered virtues rather than vices, well, then they're probably not going to be super alert, are they, to the emotional needs of their children going through the same experience?
No, it's a rolling programme of condoned abuse possibilities, I think.
It is extraordinary when I think about it. Now, I can remember, you know, being beaten by an adult with a stick to the point where it drew blood. And I can remember once doing, years later, when I'm working at the BBC, looking at a report from the NSPCC, the National Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children. And there was a photograph in it of a girl who'd been beaten by an adult. And there were these terrible bruises and welts. It looked absolutely gruesome. And then I thought, that's what we look like. That's it's what true. Happened to us.
One of my closest friends, who is 59, still has the marks on his buttocks from canings back in 1977.
That's extraordinary. I mean, meanwhile, I grew up with a school where a teacher got fired for throwing a sponge across the classroom because that was unacceptable.
And did you call your teachers by their first names?
Yeah.
So there wasn't that hierarchy built into the system.
I feel like it almost went a bit too far the other way, so there was no discipline.
Did they wear gowns and special hats and things?
No, absolutely nothing like that whatsoever. It's very, very extreme in the other direction.
Mm. Well, it's interesting, Kat, because, you know, you look at this from the outside as a Norwegian. Mm. What does it look like to you?
I mean, it looks absolutely mad. Completely, you know, and this idea that it's not a necessity, because I can see it if it is necessary in those places where you literally cannot educate your children unless they go away. But the idea that you would do that and think that it's in their benefit to be away from the family, I think in so many other places and cultures, that is just not considered an acceptable thing at all.
But they didn't have an empire to staff.
Well, precisely, well, that is what gives it that context. And reading your book, that sort of context is something that I hadn't quite realised before, that that's where it came from. And I think that really explains why it's become. And also, as you've mentioned, by the time you got there, you're in that weird point where that isn't really relevant anymore in the same way.
Oh, yes, I know. There was no empire in 1972, but we were living this bizarre existence where it was the echo of the empire. A great friend of yours, Kat, who I met, Professor Mark Horton, he went to Cheam a few years before me. And first lesson, there was a blank map of the world in his exercise book, and he had to colour in pink the bits that were British Empire.
Yeah.
So it proves that was the sort of root of it.
And I guess if you have a relatively small number of people responsible for administering vast tracts of territory with great many people in it, then it behoves them not to lapse too readily into sentimentality.
There was an edict in the early 1900s to these schools saying, we don't want hysterical types. We need tough people to administer these lands.
Beat it into them. Extraordinary.
Well, on that note, thank you. So I don't know how the disembodied voice is going to judge particular one. After that, really.
Come on, disembodied voice.
I think we've got to give it to Charles, don't we? It was a very moving topic.
Can I say, though, I actually think, if I can say it, that all three topics today were incredibly interesting.
Completely unique and different from one another. So yes. It was not an easy decision.
Right. This means war.
Right.
This means war. You think you had problems?
They're about to get a lot worse.
Well done. So you take home the coveted trophy of
Warren. Yes.
He gets a week out at Woolthorpe.
How wonderful. Yes. Well, I'll look after him and treasure him a little bit.
Yes.
Put him in the strong room.
Yes.
Make sure he's kept away from the pilfering fingers.
Excellent.
Braggarts.
So let's let our listeners know what we're going to go home and revise and work on for next week. So, Charles, can you please look at one of our favourites, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle?
At last.
Oh, yes. It keeps cropping up. Yeah. I'm going to be looking at the Epic of Gilgamesh.
Oh,
that's a brilliant topic.
Absolute favourite. And Richard, Andorra.
Yes, and you know what Andorra's got?
What?
Prince Bishops.
Of course.
I'm obsessed with them now.
Excellent. Well, I can't wait to hear all about it. So that's it for this week. Thank you to everyone for listening. Please subscribe and leave us a review because it really helps people to find us when they're searching for a new podcast to listen to. You can also send us an email if you'd like, especially if you'd like to suggest a topic. That's rabbitholedetectives@gmail.com. So, in the words from Richard Adams' Watership Down, to feel the cloud that hung over us lift and disperse, this, at least, is one joy that must have been known by almost every living creature.
Mm-hmm. Amen.
Goodbye.
Bye. Goodbye. Thank you.